Hi there, everybody. Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm here with our consultant team. Travis is still on paternity leave. So we got Megan Landris, Lauren Williams, and Justin Harvey here with us. We've been getting a lot of questions, which we always do either over email or sometimes on consults, pretty common questions that we get. So we thought we'd use this episode to answer a lot of the common questions and recent questions that we've gotten from people who have either emailed us or ones that we've gotten in our consults. So how are y'all doing today?
I'm doing great.
Good. Doing well. Thanks.
I'm super excited for this episode because there has been a lot of changes to the student loan system lately, and we're getting tons and tons of questions. So like you said, you'd think you'd run out of things to talk about as it pertains to student loans, but they always keep it interesting. And I'm really hoping that we can answer a lot of different questions for the audience.
All right. Well, let's dive in here and get right to it. So we've been getting a lot of questions on what happens if you're on pay-as-you-earn or maybe even IBR and your income goes up high enough, you recertify your income, the recertification payment is high enough that you get this scary letter saying that you no longer qualify for that partial financial hardship, and they're saying you have to change your repayment plan. Let's talk first about what partial financial hardship is and what it means if you hit that partial financial hardship and you no longer qualify, what happens to your repayment plan? So who wants to start with that one?
I'll tackle that one.
Okay, Justin.
So partial financial hardship is the mechanism by which income-driven repayment plans are made to be affordable for the payer. And what that means is if you make $50,000 or $60,000 and you owe $200,000 or $300,000, the payment amount that you're making is going to be based on the amount of income that you earn rather than the debt amount with an amortization schedule as if it were like a mortgage or something. So whether you owe $50,000 or $100,000 or $300,000, your payment is going to be the same because you have, in this case, what's called partial financial hardship. And so what that means is there's a calculation based on percentage of what's called discretionary income, which is probably a little beyond the scope of this illustration, but it will kick in anytime you're making, you know, less than, it would depend on how much your debt is. But if you're making not very much money in relation to how much you owe, if you owe one time your income or two times your income or three times your income, it will allow you to continue to have affordable payments for a very long time. And you're probably going to be on a forgiveness trajectory rather than a full repayment trajectory. Now, there is a point at which the partial financial hardship goes away. It disappears. And that point is the point at which the payment calculation is equal to your 10-year standard payment. So if we use some concrete numbers here, say I owe $300,000 from med school. I'm a resident. I'm making $62,000 a year. My payments are $275 a month. Obviously, if I owe $300,000 and I'm paying $275 a month, there's a subsidy in there. I'm not paying the full monthly payment that I should if I was to pay this off in full in 10 years. But after a few years, my income is going to go from $65,000 to $300,000. And the partial financial hardship is going to go away because if I'm on, Rob used the example pay as you earn. If I'm on pay as you earn, which yields a required payment of $275, eventually that pay as you earn amount is going to go up and up and up as I become an attending, my income goes way up and my payments go way up. Whenever that happens and my payment goes from $275 to, you know, $1,800 to $2,400, whenever I have a full year of attending income, at that point, somewhere in there, I probably have a 10-year standard payment amount threshold of, call it, I don't know, $2,100. So whenever my pay-as-you-earn calculation goes from that $1,800 to the $2,400, whenever it makes that jump, because I'm crossing over the threshold of where the 10-year standard is, that is the point at which partial financial hardship disappears.
Right. So basically what you're saying, Justin, is that if someone takes their loans and they put it as, treat it like a 10-year mortgage, let's say, and they have level payments for 10 years of the same dollar amount of payment, that's the cap. Okay. And if their income is calculated times 10% on pay as you earn and it's below that number, that counts as partial financial hardship. If they calculate that payment and it's above that 10-year mortgage payment, then they no longer qualify for partial financial hardship. And then it's capped at that 10-year level. Is that what you're saying?
That's precisely what I'm saying. Thank you for taking my word vomit and distilling it into something useful.
No problem. So Megan, why don't you tell us a little bit about what happens to the repayment plan when you hit that cap?
What happens is you will get a nasty gram, a little letter that says, hey, you no longer qualify for this income-driven plan. Call us. What'll happen is if you gave them a call, they are going to confirm that you no longer have a financial hardship. What they won't make super clear is that they cannot kick you off of that plan. And so you can stay on that pay-as-you-earn plan and continue to reap the benefit of your payment being capped at that threshold. It keeps the payment from continuing to increase with your income, and it continues to qualify for forgiveness thresholds. So public service loan forgiveness, longer-term forgiveness if relevant. The only plan that this does not work with, though, is revised pay-as-you-earn. Revised pay-as-you-earn or repay does not have a payment cap. So this is only in regards to pay-as-you-earn and income-based repayment and income-contingent repayment if relevant.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things we have to think about here when we're talking with clients is sometimes that cap can be beneficial. Like if someone's going for public service loan forgiveness, well, let's just take it to the point where let's just say someone hits that cap and they have more than 10 years to go until their loans are forgiven, like without PSLF. Like they're 5 years in to pay as you earn and they hit that cap. And now if they make that payment for 10 years, they're going to pay off their loans in full. So that becomes kind of an inefficient thing because they end up paying off a high interest rate loan over a longer period of time. So for PSLF, this is very beneficial. Like in Justin's example, where we talk about a resident physician who, you know, maybe when they become an attending physician, they hit that cap and they're capped at that payment. Well, they're still going to save money going for PSLF. But I guess the bottom line is if you hit that cap, you're going to get a scary letter and they're going to say you no longer qualify. And sometimes they'll imply that you have to change your repayment plan. But that could be very, very bad if you switch to repay. So when you get that letter, it's almost like you have to take note of it. But oftentimes you want to ignore it or else, you know, you can end up paying a lot more towards your loans than you otherwise would have to. We've seen circumstances where they say, oh no, I don't qualify anymore. I have to switch to repay. Well, now their payment is above the cap and they're working down their loan and paying too much. Mm-hmm. So anyway, partial financial hardship. And if the income goes up high enough, your payment will be capped and it will count towards those loan forgiveness, whether it's taxable on pay or IBR. And it will also count for PSLF. But we don't want the cap to go on too long where people are ending up paying off their loans in full, you know, at the high interest rates of their federal loans. Anything else to add to that before we jump to the next question?
Yeah, just one thing I was thinking of too is I actually had a case recently where this was very relevant is that, you know, when you're on a plan for a while, you kind of get away from like what the cap is and you're not really sure. So, you know, you get out of school and you owe $200,000 of debt and you've been on pay as you earn or IBR, whichever payment plan for a while and paying way less than you should be paying to pay the loans off. You get 5 years down the road and your loans are now $250,000, you're like, oh, well, I don't really know what the standard 10-year number is. And most calculators won't show you what that is. So you have to kind of go back and make sure you understand what was the original loan balance that I borrowed and what's my cap based on that. So I had a physician this weekend that was 9 years into PSLF and hit that cap about 2 years ago. So the last 3 years of paying, he's been paying at the cap. But, you know, initially going into that, we didn't realize, you know, whether or not he had been or not. And we were kind of talking through the information. We did find out, like, you know, he was paying at the cap, but it was like, well, this can't be the right number because he's like his loan balance and, you know, what I'm calculating as a 10-year cap, but we have to go back and do the math based on what was your original loan balance to understand what that cap is. So that's an important part. And that's where we come in at Student Loan Planner is helping people understand what is that 10-year number if you don't know it right off the bat.
For sure.
Another way you can have an idea of what this number is each year you get that recertification notice, like, hey, it's time to update your income. There will also be a line on that letter that says, if you don't, this will be what your payment is. And what they're telling you is if you don't recertify, your payment's going to revert back to the standard 10-year payment. And so if you ever wanted to reference maybe an idea of what that number would be, that letter is a great reference.
Great point. Okay, well, let's move to another question. Let's talk about consolidating loans. So I know a lot of us, we've seen people when we ask for their NSLDS file, which shows all their federal loans, sometimes they are, and the direct federal loans are the ones, especially for PSLF, that will qualify. But sometimes people have these other loans like HPSLs, the health profession student loans, or Perkins loans. I've gotten some questions on whether they qualify for PSLF or longer term forgiveness, or can consolidation be used to qualify for PSLF or longer term forgiveness?
I was pulling up the cancelability of Perkins loans. So I was going to look up the exact terms for it. But yes, so the Perkins loans are going to show up on your federal file. You'll see that if you sign into studentaid.gov. You are not going to see the health professional loans that are most of the time with Heartland as the servicer. But these loans can be consolidated into the federal direct loan system to where you can pursue public service loan forgiveness, or at least just have them all on the same page. And I had a case like this recently where someone had both Perkins loans and health professional loans. And so they had three different servicers, including their federal loans and three different payments. And they weren't all going towards the same objective, which for this person was forgiveness towards public service loan forgiveness. And so they were asking, you know, am I able to allow those other loans to qualify? And the answer is yes. You just have to consolidate those together. The Perkins loans will show up if you do the online consolidation application, where you can check the box and include that in your consolidation. It will give you a warning, however, that if you qualify for Perkins loan cancellation, you might want to second guess that consolidation. So this would be relevant for folks who are a teacher. You want to take a look at this Perkins loan cancellation information. If you're an early childhood education provider, some other professions are a firefighter, law enforcement, librarian, military service, nurse, or medical technician. These terms are very specific. So you want to communicate with your Perkins loan servicer or your school. That's who issued the loans. They don't issue them now, but you'd have to communicate with your school to figure out exactly what qualifies for that cancellation and if it's worth holding on to them as the Perkins loan form, or if it's better to just loop them into the rest of your loan forgiveness trajectory. So that's the Perkins side. The health professional loans, though, those are not going to show up on your federal file. You will have to manually add those. And are you guys familiar with other loans that you could add in addition to the health professional loans?
So actually, if you go to the studentaid.gov website and you kind of walk through the demo, there's a large drop-down menu of all types of different loans. And so this is one of my biggest frustrations. Like, one of the things that makes this work very rewarding is that we're kind of astute to these things that exist and we can help people walk through this. But, you know, you just brought up a whole set of loans that most people don't know can actually get access to the federal system, and no one tells you. I can't think of a time that a client has come and had health professional loans and knew that they could get them into the federal system. They're always shocked and amazed, and they're like, what? This is so cool, Lauren. But there is, if you go to, like I said, studentaid.gov and you look at the consolidation and you kind of walk through, there's a demo process. Even if you don't want to log in, it'll show you the drop-down menu of all the various types of loans that exist that can be consolidated into the federal system. And I was just mentioning, like, I'm frustrated because sometimes there's loans that you think would be able to be consolidated. I'm excited and I go to the site and I don't see them. And I always tell my clients to, you know, double check with their servicer to make sure that they can't get in. And so recently I had a client that had HHS loans, HHS being the Department of Health and Human Services, which is a government agency that is issuing loans. And this particular person was issued the loans because they qualified as a disadvantaged dental student. So, you know, their parents met certain requirements to be able to get these loans, and they're offered by, you know, a .gov agency or government agency. So you would think like, oh, those should be federal loans, but they're not showing up on the system. Maybe they're like health professional loans and can be added in. We're still not sure. I'm waiting to hear back on whether or not they could be added in, but I don't think that they are going to be added in. And this is where we kind of get to that buyer beware part of, you know, looking at what you're borrowing before you borrow it. So dental school is very expensive. You know, we frequently consult on $400,000+ of dental school loan debt. And so, you know, this gentleman took the loans because his family was disadvantaged. There's supposed to be some advantage to taking these disadvantaged loans, but they ended up being 5% loans. And if he can't get them into the federal system, he's going to have to pay them back. And so they're effectively a private loan. And he's definitely a candidate for forgiveness. So wouldn't it have been better, instead of taking a disadvantaged dental loan, thinking that there was going to be some benefit because your family is not well off, or, you know, you fall into a particular income range, to just take the federal loans and then deal with them, either refinancing if you have the income to support it, or getting access to the benefits of the federal system later on. So not all loans are created equally. And it's really sad to hear that, you know, you may come from a disadvantaged background and think that someone's offering you something that's going to help. And it's not necessarily helping because there's the federal system and it might actually be more helpful.
Yeah, that's a great point, Lauren. Go ahead, Justin.
One other thing to think about in this discussion is it's generally a best practice to get your loans to be homogenous as soon as you can. So if you've got the situation Megan described, where you got a couple Perkins and then you got some HPSLs and you got some federal direct loans and you're, you know, doing whatever you're doing, especially if you're going for PSLF, you're making payments on all these loans for a year, two, three, 4 years. If you're 4 years in and they're like, oh man, half of these loans don't qualify for PSLF, maybe I should consolidate the HPSLs and the Perkins and turn them all into direct loans. You could do that. But the net effect is you would now have two tranches of loans. You would have federal loans that you have 4 years worth of payment history towards forgiveness. And then you have federal loans that have 0 years of payment history that used to be Perkins slash HPSL loans. And the net effect of that is you have to make payments for another 10 years because if you're doing PSLF, the loans on which you had 4 years of credit, those are going to drop off 6 years from now. But the loans on which you have 0 years of credit still require 10 years worth of payments. That can be a real bummer, especially if you can just consolidate them out of the blocks, then you save years of unnecessary payments.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of, Lauren, like you were saying, buyer beware too. When people take out loans, they're just looking to get money to finish school so they can get the education and their degree, and they may not understand the options. And for those of you in that situation, we do, if you go to studentloanplanner.com/pre-debt, we actually do pre-debt consults before you take out the loans to help you there. People always say, you know, if they're about to graduate in the next year or two, when's the best time to get a consult? And I usually say, like, right before you graduate, when you know where you're going to be working, when you know what your job looks like lined up. Because then we have the income information, we have all the loan information, and we can tell you, because there's a lot of stuff that can be done right after graduation, but before starting the job, to really save money on student loans. And like Justin was talking about, if you can consolidate all these loans together from the get-go, then they're all on the same track. And then there are also certain circumstances, like Megan, like you said, where consolidating Perkins loans might not make sense because they're going to get forgiven anyway. So it can be a big hodgepodge. It can be a little bit of a mess. But if you have any questions on what loans can be consolidated, you can go to studentaid.gov. And oftentimes I'll recommend calling the consolidation hotline. There's a number to call and they'll be able to tell you if these loans can be consolidated or not. So, but anyway, make sure you have all of your loans together from all different sources. Could be from the college you attended, from, you know, health profession student loans. They could be Perkins loans. Obviously, the Stafford and Grad Plus loans are all going to be in the same place. Or maybe you have a situation where your parents took out loans in your name and you have your loans and your parents' loans. All these situations are unique and could require different repayment strategies or different ways of looking at it. So it's really important, if you have a mix of loans, to get everything together, take a good close look at it. And if you do need help, then you can go to studentloanplanner.com/help and get a consult with us too, so we can help you get through that too. You know, ultimately the goal is to save you as much money as possible so you can keep it in your pocket and get as much forgiven as possible, or just have the strategy that's going to save you the most money paying back your loans. And with the mix of loans, it kind of depends on what strategies are available to you.
It almost always requires proactivity. Mm-hmm. There's certain cases in which you can kind of sit back and make the payment that's required and it's not going to hurt you. But if you have three different types of loans, almost every time you're on a suboptimal track. So if you're out there and you're thinking, that kind of describes my situation, like make sure you have a plan and you're taking the appropriate action.
All right. Let's get to our next question, which has to do, I'm sure a lot of you have been seeing out there talking with people who employers are starting to offer benefits, student loan repayment benefits, where they'll either give you a chunk of money up front, or they'll give people an extra, you know, monthly amount of money to put towards their student loans. And these can be good and bad. And oftentimes we see employers, they're trying to do the right thing, but it might not be the best thing for the people who actually have the student loans to implement the plans. So let's talk a little bit about that and maybe some of the benefits and also the traps of these employer benefits that companies are offering. Maybe I'll tee it off by just saying that there are a lot of times where employers give the employee a chunk of change to pay off their student loans, and the person with the student loans takes the money and throws them all at the loans. And what happens is, it oftentimes, unless you let your loan servicer know, it puts your loans in paid ahead status. So now it kind of throws off, if you're going for loan forgiveness, it throws off your ability to get that. So that's something to watch out for. What do you think, Justin?
I think that it's always good to understand the terms of one of these benefit arrangements. And there are some cases in which it's like another line item on your pay stub. Like, we're giving you $500 as pay period, and it's going to be in your checking account. And it's sort of loosely earmarked, in air quotes, for student loans, but it's just like anything else. And it's essentially increased pay for you. That is very different than somebody who says, or a benefits offer, where your employer is saying, we'll pay $500 a month, or we'll pay $20,000 per year towards your loans, and we got to write the check to the servicer, and it's not allowed to pass through your checking account. The first is, in my opinion, almost always desirable, because cash in your checking account is tough to beat. The second option, a bunch of money towards your loans, may be helpful if you're going for full repayment. But if you're on any type of forgiveness strategy, it's almost certain to be, again, suboptimal, because you're just paying off loans that would have been forgiven anyway. So the company thinks they're doing you a big favor by paying off $20,000. But in reality, they're just paying off a bunch of money that maybe in another 6 years from PSLF would have just dropped off as a sort of a function of the PSLF program. So understanding the true monetary value of any program that an employer offers, as well as the mechanics of how the program works, is very, very important.
And I think that brings up a good point too about being educated about your loan, so you can circle back to your employer, because we see it frequently, which means the employer doesn't necessarily know or understand how student loans work. If it's a nonprofit employer, you know, majority of the people who work at that facility should be going for PSLF. Now, like you said, not every student loan situation is created equally. So if you got private loans, you probably need that help to pay the loans off. But, you know, maybe circling back to your employer, if you've done a consultation with us, or you just learned that from this podcast, and saying, hey, you know, you guys are a PSLF employer, like, maybe you should consider giving a signing bonus instead of, like, don't be afraid to go back and kind of negotiate, or just bring it to someone's attention, because they just don't know sometimes, and they don't know that they're not helping their employees, and they have the best of intentions. But if, you know, if they could give you a $15,000 raise instead of $20,000 towards your loans, and that saves the company $5,000, that might be ideal for everybody. So it's important to know that, say that, and explain that to the employers as well.
And to reiterate too on what Rob said initially starting the conversation, getting yourself into paid ahead status is not good if you're pursuing public service loan forgiveness or even the longer term forgiveness, because you're not issued a required monthly payment the following month. So what I mean by this is oftentimes I'll have folks in this situation who are like, oh yeah, my employer, you know, paid $1,000 towards my loan this month, and they think they're going to do that quarterly or something. And it's like, okay, how far ahead did that push your loan schedule? Because you need to call your servicer and tell them to get you out of paid ahead status, or else your future payments are not going to count. And so it does just go down to, what path are we on? Are we pursuing forgiveness? Is that additional, you know, because it sounds like a great benefit, like, oh, great, your employer is paying towards your loans. But with the complexity of the federal system, that might not be a great benefit at the end of the day. It might not be helping you at all, and it might be a big waste of money for your employer. So I like Lauren's idea with going back and saying, hey, based on my loan trajectory and my path, this would actually be better for me if you can incorporate that into my benefits, you know, versus this route because X, Y, and Z. And that's something we can easily help walk you through based on your specific circumstances through our consults as well.
Yeah. One other kind of buyer beware as it pertains to various, you know, loan repayment programs. So I have a client that her company offers like $100 a month toward her student loans. And so because she has federal loans, she's going for forgiveness, and other loans that she, like a small amount of private loans, we're applying that $110 toward the private loans, which is, you know, a great idea. But we actually were sharing screen and logged in, and I saw like the way it was. And the majority of the actual website where you go to sign up for this employer benefit is all about refinancing. So if you don't know better, and you know, this client has tons of loans that are great for forgiveness, like, you must have to click maybe 50 times before you can actually find where to link the account and get the $110 benefit. And then all along the way, they're selling you refinance, click here, do this. And so a lot of these companies that employers are working through to get the benefit, they're making their main money by getting people to refinance. So be very careful. you know, you may be looking for that $110 to pay off a small amount of loans. And if you don't know very much about your loans, or, you know, they telling you, hey, new interest rate here, da da da, before you know it, you refinance $300,000 of student loan debt because this website just kept trying to force you to, and it wasn't the best thing for you overall. So just know that while there's a benefit, you know, there's also a benefit to that company, and they make money off of what you don't know.
That's a great point, because I have seen that more frequently where it is just that, like it's a refinancing platform where they have some kind of partnership or relationship with a lender, and they do. They make more money off of a refinance versus giving you the advice. And so that is something to be aware of, and make sure if you are refinancing, if it's a great option or benefit, fantastic, but make sure you know, similar to what Justin said on our first consultant podcast episode, you know, make sure you have a good reason, or you know exactly why you're refinancing. Don't just pull the trigger willy-nilly. It's something you need to think about, because that is a permanent decision.
I think the employers would really appreciate it too, if they actually, if someone who is in the situation of receiving a benefit that's probably too generous, in other words, it's not helping the employee, but it's hurting the employer, I think the employer would be pretty happy to know about that. And you might even be able to say, hey, I know you're giving me $20,000 to pay back my student loans. My payment is such that I only really need like $10,000. I don't want to take this money from the company if it's not really doing anything. And, you know, but maybe you can negotiate like a $5,000 raise, you know, split the difference. And maybe you could, if, because sometimes these benefits are taxed. And if they're going to be taxed, you'd rather it be best used as an employee, and the employer would rather that happen too. Maybe we could talk about too, you know, as we're closing up this question, the difference between getting a lump sum payment and how to use that versus the company giving monthly distributions.
So the lump sum payment will kind of revert back to what me and you were talking about, Rob, with the paid ahead status. Dropping a lump sum on your loans, if you're not planning on paying them off, will affect your forgiveness timeline, regardless, on PSLF or longer term forgiveness. And it does not speed up your time frame. Sometimes that's a misconception that people have, is they think, oh, well, I'm 10 payments ahead with that lump sum I just dropped. No, not at all, because only a payment once per month counts towards forgiveness. And so a lump sum from that perspective, it can be detrimental to your forgiveness timeline. Is that what you meant though? Or did I miss the mark there?
Yeah. No, for sure. No, I mean, a lot of times what we tell people is, if they give you the lump sum and you have to use it all, use it to, you know what your payments are going to be if you're on an income-driven plan. So hold that amount back and use that money to fund your monthly payments. In other words, you don't have to throw all the money at the loans. And we see this a lot with people who get money from the National Health Service Corps. Well, they get like $50,000 to pay over 2 years and they have to use the money up. But sometimes I think, well, I'll just take the $50,000 and pay down my highest interest loans, and then I'll make the monthly payments on my own. But it actually saves someone more money, especially if they're going for PSLF. If they hold back the amount of money that they're going to have to be making their monthly payments with and use that money to make their payments, and then either at the beginning or the end of the payment period, throw the whatever's left over at the highest interest rate loan after the fact as sort of like a hedge in case PSLF doesn't work out or they change employers or something like that. So similar rules can apply if it's a private company that you're working for, or a nonprofit company that gives you a lump sum rather than from like the NHSC or something like that.
Does anyone know if during COVID, because you're in the COVID forbearance, those that are attacking their loans right now, if they're going to end up in paid ahead status and they're going to come out of COVID forbearance not having to pay their loans for 2 years when they thought they were paying their loans down?
I don't think they should, because they're not in repayment status at all. They're in forbearance. So I don't think that should affect the timeline.
Okay, so let's move to another question. I mean, obviously, it's a hard time for a lot of families out there, and people are struggling to pay their bills, and some people might even have enough debt where they're considering bankruptcy. There's a lot of information about bankruptcy and student loans that you can't bankrupt student loans. But there might be some cases where student loans can be forgiven in bankruptcy. Now, we're not advising that anyone go into bankruptcy, because that's kind of like a last resort. Maybe we could talk a little bit about some things we've been seeing in bankruptcy and how it affects loan forgiveness, or how student loans are affected through the bankruptcy process.
You want to start, Lauren, since you wrote on it on your email blast?
Yeah, so we had a pretty cool development recently where a young lady did actually get loans discharged in bankruptcy. This happens very, very infrequently, though, but it did sort of set precedent. It set precedent for a very small group of states that are under the Circuit 10 District Court. but it can be done. So we don't want to give people, like you said, false hope and thinking like, oh, just take a bunch of private loans, file for bankruptcy, it'll all disappear. You have to prove that, like, you know, that there's this hardship above and beyond what is happening in the bankruptcy in order to get these loans discharged. So it's something to be mindful of, but it's also something to consider.
Yeah, it's primarily been seen with private student loans more so. So a lot of the headlines you have been seeing, if at all, have been about private student loans. And so these are more eligible for bankruptcy, I guess I could say, because they don't have income-driven plans associated with them. And so the private lenders will only offer you a payment based off of the balance, the interest rate, and the term, whichever you are committed to. To go through bankruptcy and to successfully win your case, you have to prove that you have undue hardship, which means you are unable to financially provide for your family, your basic needs, and make those required monthly payments, which is easier to do with private loans because they do not offer income-driven plans. In the federal system, that's not necessarily the case. You can really only get your loans discharged in for your federal loans if there's some kind of fraudulent case for the school you went to. Maybe they misled you and made you think that you'd make X amount post-graduation, or you'd only leave with X amount of student loans, something like that. But when it comes to just your financial situation, it's really hard to claim that undue hardship because you have access to income-driven plans, which your payment could be as low as $0 a month. And so, and they all are associated, they have a longer-term forgiveness threshold to where they won't carry on forever. And so that's why maybe it has been said that student loans are very difficult to be discharged, because federal loans are extremely difficult to be discharged. But private loans, we're starting to see a little more hope in the sense that if there truly is an undue hardship and the circumstances align, that that's something you can maybe pursue.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting, too, that for the young lady who got her loans discharged, that the court actually ruled that the full loan amount was not taken for cost of attendance. So the other thing we're seeing quite frequently with student loans is people are borrowing, and it's not just tuition and books and, you know, basic things that need to be taken care of. But now they're doing this calculation that's called cost of attendance, where I also can't work, or I need to, you know, pay rent, have somewhere to live so I can dedicate to my schooling full time. And so there's a number there. But when you're taking private loans, it's a little bit harder to say, like, was this fully cost of attendance? And so she was able to prove that this was not just cost of attendance that the loan was taken for. And so it kind of seemed like, oh, it's like a private loan. I took it to buy a car, or, you know, maybe we don't know exactly what she did with the money, but it wasn't just specific to student loans. And that's how she was able to get a discharge. So once again, don't just go get some private loans and say like, oh, I'll figure out how to get a discharge. This was a very unique situation where she was able to prove above and beyond. And that specific court was able to do that.
And this is where, of course, we say we're not attorneys. So if you have questions about bankruptcy or bankruptcy law, definitely consult an attorney, because we are not those. But nonetheless, it is interesting to hear this. And I think, you know, this new case, Lauren, that you wrote about and just talked about, might be interesting to see what happens with that. You know, and kind of that being said, you know, we talked about how people are on hard times, and any federal loans right now that are held by the Department of Education, as we all know, are on forbearance, zero interest, zero payments. But if people do have, maybe we could talk a little bit about if people have those FFEL loans held by commercial banks, or if they have private loans, maybe some tactics they can use to ease the burden so that they can take the edge off of the financial stress that they might be under at this time. So maybe with FFEL loans, we could start by saying, those can be consolidated possibly to become direct loans and then be eligible for the CARES Act forbearance. That might be one option. Consolidation is not for everybody and depends on a couple of different factors, but that could be an option. And what do you think, Megan?
Yeah, I was going to say with FFEL loans, sometimes this is confusing. And I've had a lot of client calls where we had to go through kind of the technicalities on this because their servicer wasn't able to articulate this well. But with FFEL loans, they could be either issued commercially, they could have because they don't issue them anymore, but prior to 2010, they could have been either issued commercially or federally. Federally held student loans, as we know, are participating in this CARES Act student loan relief. But commercially held FFEL loans, even though they're federal, They're not held federally. And so those are kind of treated like private loans right now. So those are loans that, again, if consolidation makes sense for you, you can consolidate to open access to those benefits, to pause payments, to freeze interest. And they will also be eligible for other income-driven plans as well, consolidated. So that's one way that you can seek relief if you have those FFEL loans. Another way is if you just have private loans, certain servicers have been offering a disaster forbearance where you can take advantage of it for a couple months, 1 to 3 months. Interest will still accrue. So keep that in mind, but it is maybe a pause on payments to where you're not going backwards. You're not, you know, it's not negatively impacting credit by having a missed payment or not paying in full. So that's something you can maybe take advantage of as well with private loans.
Yeah, and like we talked about two episodes back where we talked about if someone has private loans and they're able to refinance to a longer term to lower their required payment, if that would help. And then once people get back on their feet financially, they can then, you know, pay off the loans aggressively on the same time frame they were before. So, but we know it's hard times for a lot of you out there. And even when times are good, student loans can also, you know, feel like you're under hard times. So there are options for you. You know, no matter what your student loan situation is, have a plan that has your student loan repayment that's built around the life you want to live and the career you want to fulfill. So just know that there are options for you. I know a lot of you are having challenging times there right now.
I think that's a theme, Rob, for me, that's come up a few times lately is I've talked to people who they come in with student loans are just so overwhelming and intimidating, and they just feel depressed about it. And they have this assumption that like my life is forever going to be defined by this. And what we end up finding is whether it's PSLF, whether it's taxable forgiveness, some other sort of plan, often involving an income-driven repayment strategy, we can cut a path for them into the future that is very doable, gives them significant monthly free cash flow to do the mortgage or like make the car payments or like the other things where they were like really stressed and just anxious. We frequently find that it's not nearly as bad as you think if you take full advantage of all the different options at your disposal.
Great point, Justin. Okay, so let's go over like one or two other questions here. Looks like Megan, maybe you got a question about if schools are going to reduce their cost of attendance going forward since there's a lot of online learning going on. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we have actually been seeing schools doing a couple different things. One, they're doing tuition freezes, which doesn't really mean what I thought it meant when I read it, but it means that they're not implementing the standard like cost of inflation that most schools do every single year. They'll add another 3% or 5% to their cost of attendance, keeping up with inflation, quote, quote. So a lot of colleges have been doing a freeze where they haven't implemented that change. Really, that's only worth, depending on how much the cost of tuition is, it's only worth like a couple hundred dollars, maybe $300 to $600. So it's not as big of a relief as maybe folks would like, but there are other schools doing tuition discounts. And there's a couple different avenues that people can get tuition discounts. It's either, you know, if your household makes under a certain amount of income, it's if your household was directly impacted by COVID, either income-wise or by contracting COVID-19. And then, you know, there's certain states that are implementing more scholarships and more grants for folks to be able to attend. So it is an interesting time because this is the first year we're probably going to see most colleges across the board not skyrocket in cost of attendance or just not increase in general. And so it does kind of beg the question of, you know, what is this going to look like in the future? Because, you know, a lot of these fees and expenses that are tacked on to tuition are tied to debt obligations. And so, you know, these colleges have built buildings, they've built pools, gyms, you know, these fees are tied to these things that have to be paid back. And so it'll be interesting to see kind of what happens next, if cost of attendance in the future is going to go up and maybe decrease demand because it's starting to become less and less affordable, or if there's going to be a change in system, like maybe a lot of colleges are going to go more online. Maybe that does warrant a reduction in costs overall, but that's what I've been seeing. I recently wrote an article on this. It'll come out soon, but it is really interesting the time that we're in. Maybe this is what pops student loan interest or student loan balance bubble. Who knows?
I'm definitely hoping so. You know, like you said, we're in unprecedented times. And I think, you know, we do a lot of talking about how we can band together. That's kind of the narrative in the world in general right now, whether it's political, upcoming elections, and all the various things. We are definitely stronger together. And, you know, while, like you said, there are debt obligations and these schools are businesses and there are jobs tied to these businesses, we do know that the cost of education is ridiculous. It's been unfair and that it's grossly affecting people's lives and the overall economy. So now more than ever is the time where we can be thinking about banding together. And I know Travis is a big proponent of, you know, writing your state representative, so whether that's a congressman or what have you, to be vocal, because people are kind of like, oh, I'm being stuck by the man, you know, school's getting ready to start. And we're, you know, we're kind of all taking it because everybody's in unprecedented times. Tuition's the same, but we're online. You hear the conversations privately of like, why am I paying the same amount to do this from my house when I'm not in my dorm? You can be more vocal. You can write to people. You can get, you know, student organizations together so that you can take action against this, because maybe tuition should be going down and maybe we should be looking at making it more affordable for the individual. So if ever there was a time to speak up, the time is now.
That's a great point, and it's a good one to wrap up this podcast on. I think bottom line is, we're Student Loan Planner, we're all here to help you. You know, the four of us plus Travis and the entire team, we want to make sure that you are in the best position possible given your student loan debt. And even if a consult isn't right for you, or you feel like your situation doesn't warrant that, we are dedicated to plenty of free content. If you go to studentloanplanner.com, there's a resources tab. We got free calculators. If you go to our blog, depending on what profession you're in, we have specific posts related to your profession and the hardships related to student loans and how to combat those and how to come out the other side in a better position. We are here to help you, and we want to make sure that you know that. We obviously have the consults. We have studentloanplanner.com/help, but there's also plenty of free content that we want to be there to help you no matter what your financial situation is.
Thank you for listening to today's show. If you know that you need a custom student loan plan, you can schedule one today at studentloanplanner.com/book. You can find the show notes for today's episode at studentloanplanner.com/the number of the episode. And finally, if you like the podcast, leave us a review or share it with someone who owes more than you. Have a great week.